You are listening to Radio Regent. This is Saturday Morning Live, and we now go to Black Agenda Report.
Jill Quidongo teaches sociology at Florida State University. She's author of the book, The Color of Welfare, How Racism Undermined the War on Poverty. Professor Quidongo says a lot has changed in a half century. Even Republican President Richard Nixon seriously considered supporting a guaranteed national minimum income.
Well, we'd have to put that in the context of the 1960s. It was a time when people really believed much more powerfully than they do today that the government could do good. And Nixon's plan came on the wake of Johnson's war on poverty that created job training programs, community action, VISTA, Medicare, Medicaid, a whole series of programs that impacted people in almost every aspect of their lives. And so Nixon's plan was that everybody in the country would receive a guaranteed minimum income. At that time, it was $300 a month per person. And that gradually, with work effort, you would be able to keep part of that so that the lowest paid worker would still be better off than a non-worker. And the idea of that was to eliminate all of the various poverty programs, which at the time was AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, and all the benefits that went along with that, and just to create one, simplify the whole social welfare system with one guaranteed minimum income and then a subsidy for wage work to encourage work. So it had some appeal for both liberals and conservatives. And it's an idea that now I think would be totally impossible to even conceive of such an idea. But what happened to it was that it actually got through the House of Representatives and received a positive vote. But it got killed in the Senate because of a coalition of a variety of different groups that normally don't work together. Southern Democrats didn't like it because they felt like the guaranteed minimum income was actually higher than the wages that a lot of Southerners received and that it would undermine the low-wage labor force, even though the idea was to encourage work. Some organizations of welfare mothers, particularly in the New York area, opposed it because they were actually receiving higher welfare benefits. And in high-cost areas like New York and L.A., they would have lost income. Organized labor didn't like it because it felt like to them that it was a subsidy for low-wage labor that would have undermined union wages. And so we had a variety. Even some church groups opposed it because they feared that it would entrench the government and the government would take over responsibility that belonged with local communities and families. And so this curious coalition ended any hope that that program would succeed, and it died in the Senate. But the idea at the time was so revolutionary. What we did get out of it, however, was the earned income tax credit that was enacted in 1975 and that was put into place during the Carter administration and then expanded greatly under Clinton, even under Reagan to some extent. And that basically gives working people back pretty much all of their payroll taxes, and then for lower-income workers, a subsidy beyond that. So many people pay no taxes and then get an additional amount back. And the earned income tax credit is very appealing, again, for some of the same reasons that the negative income tax, Nixon's plan, because it rewards work. And so both conservatives and liberals have supported it and supported its expansion over several decades.
You say that's an idea that is totally impossible to conceive of today, but what are we talking about today? What are progressives pushing today in the face of austerity?
Well, one of the ideas is to reduce income inequality. and that you hear more and more about. You've heard President Obama talk about reducing income inequality, that income inequality has increased substantially over the last few decades, and that we should do something to reduce that. So that's a grand goal, but the question is how much income inequality is okay. What do we tolerate in terms of income inequality, and how do we reduce it? The best way to reduce it would be to tax more affluent people more and redistribute more income to the poor. The first part of that equation is generally popular, but when you talk about redistributing wealth, you start getting into less feasible ideas for a lot of people. I think we've already done one ambitious thing, which is the Affordable Care Act, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which will help people maintain their income because it provides free health insurance for poor and low-income people by expanding Medicaid, and it also provides subsidies through the exchanges so that working people with low and moderate incomes can have funds that will help them pay for health insurance. And having health insurance coverage is a way to avoid bankruptcy and helps to protect people's assets and savings. So I think the one thing that President Obama has done that is not yet appreciated and is obviously still very controversial is to provide a route for people to have health insurance that will protect their income and provide greater security.
As you say, President Obama now is talking a lot about income inequalities. His answer is promise zones. Do promise zones bear any relationship to the war on poverty as we knew it?
Promise zone ideas have periodically reappeared in American politics, and the closest thing that we had during Johnson's war on poverty were the community action programs where local groups within communities would apply for grants and they could then start community health centers that would provide medical services, food banks, job and literacy training, drug rehabilitation, even migrant workers assistance. So they weren't zones in the same sense as these promise zones, but they were money that went to communities for community improvement. Some of those worked very well, and we still have some community health centers that began in the 1960s. In other places, the programs became entangled in the struggle for civil rights and created a white backlash against the programs, and so they were cut back substantially. For instance, one program was called Operation Star that went to two Catholic priests in Mississippi. Mississippi at that time was entirely segregated in terms of just about every phase of life. And what Star did was to create racially integrated vocational training programs that included black and white teachers and black and white students. It was the first racial integration education in the state of Mississippi, and they had the facilities of the Catholic Church where they could bypass the local segregated school system entirely. But what happened was that there was a huge backlash against Star, as you can imagine, in 1966 in Mississippi, and eventually the funds were cut for the program. So the war on poverty didn't have promise zones in the same sense of what Obama is talking about, although there have been other similar efforts. The problem is a continuous stream of funding and good administration. So it's a hopeful thing, and we'll just have to wait and see how this actually works.
Isn't it logical, however, that programs that would empower poor people would become entangled or be subject to white backlash or business backlash?
Yes, I mean, that was the pattern with a lot of the anti-poverty programs in the 1960s and 70s as well. For instance, one of the more ambitious programs of the war on poverty was job training, and this was to train poor, less educated people for jobs in the skilled trades, especially for males, jobs as carpenters and brick masons, jobs that paid well. And a high percentage of the trainees in the job training programs were African Americans, because it was targeted at the poor who had less of a chance for education. So it was natural that this would be the constituency. But what happened was, when young black men came out of the job training programs ready to be carpenters, ready to be plumbers, ready to be electricians, and they applied for jobs in cities like Chicago, like Detroit, like Philadelphia, they found that those jobs were closed to them because the trades unions' key negotiating point with employers was that they control hiring. And for decades, they had hired their sons, their nephews. Some places they were controlled by an ethnic group. And so the trainees coming out of the job training programs were a direct threat to their prerogative to choose who was hired on the job. And for the most part, these unions were racially segregated. And so that created a backlash. The trade unions in the skilled trades were a major constituency of the Democratic Party, and that helped turn them eventually into Reagan Republicans, because they resented being forced to hire trainees that weren't members of the unions, or to make these trainees into union members to allow them to become a part of the union. And that was really the beginning of affirmative action, was these skilled trade jobs. How do you prove that unions aren't discriminating? Well, you have to have some sort of numbers of what percent of individuals on the job are minorities, and that means quotas, and quotas create backlash. So that's the perfect example of that kind of backlash being created by programs intended to do well.
One of your books is titled The Color of Welfare: How Racism Undermined the War on Poverty. How much does racism have to do with popular support for today's austerity?
I think that there is less overt racism than there was in the 1960s, in the sense that you don't see colored white signs on drinking fountains, on entrances to hospitals, in schools, but there's coded racial messages that still trigger racial resentment. For instance, during the last presidential campaign, when Newt Gingrich talked about cutting back food stamps, I believe that he was also implying that racial minorities are the undeserving poor who receive food stamps because they don't want to work. And I think people hear that code in those messages and understand that that's what is really being discussed. When President Reagan promised to cut back welfare as we know it, he talked about the welfare mother driving around in a Cadillac, you know, and using her food stamps to buy beer. So those are coded, maybe not so overt, but still coded racial messages that are present today in discussions about policy debates.
Jill Quadagno of Florida State University.
A new book is out that for the first time reveals the identity of three people who broke into the offices of the FBI in Media, Pennsylvania in 1971 and made public the files on the Bureau's COINTEL program. The book is titled The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, appeared on WBAI Pacifica Radio, Law and Disorder, hosted by National Lawyers Guild Executive Director Heidi Boghossian. Mumia recalls how he first heard about the break-in 43 years ago.
I remember with quite a degree of distinction receiving in the mail a packet full of Xeroxed FBI files. I believe believe by 1971 I had left the party. And so this was like a double, triple, a blockbuster. I sat and I read through files that really named names and detailed internal affairs of the Black Panther Party of Philadelphia, the national office, other organizations, activists all throughout the city and the region. And it was a mind blower again, especially imagine reading about someone that you lived with as a comrade, as a brother in an organization, you know. For what that means is for members of the party, we lived in communal apartments and houses. We lived together, we worked out of the same office, and we spent all day together with each other. And to read about lives that were in those files and then people that you knew for years who were FBI informants and stuff like that, it was absolutely mind-blowing. But it proved everything that we thought, and it kind of confirmed every suspicion. So to see this, the news, right, from Media Pennsylvania, is quite refreshing and amazing in many respects that these people held that secret for over 40 years.
Do you think they came forth because of the changing attention to NSA surveillance, Ed Snowden, the other whistleblowers who've come forward?
I think they are the linear ancestors of Edward Snowden. You know, back in those days, you had to find paper, right? Not emails or electronic messages. But these were anti-war people, for the most part, living their own lives, but also wanting to make a contribution, right, to the movement, because they were part of the movement. They were part of the anti-war movement. When we talk about Media Pennsylvania, most of us, unless you're of a certain age, it doesn't ring a bell to you, right? Those files that were ripped off from the media offices of the FBI showed that every organization of any kind of notoriety, actors, artists, women's groups, all kinds of organizations were followed by the FBI, you know, for really practicing their constitutional rights. It was mind-blowing, and I remember very, very well. After that, I think that is the one thing that made the Church Commission hearings possible. And it really exposed what was happening all across the country. It's interesting that these files come out now because, you know, for someone who's been reading and writing recently about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., people know now that the FBI taped hotel rooms where Martin and Ralph David Abernathy and other civil rights activists, you know, were staying, and taped office and phone calls and that kind of stuff. Well, they tried to use those tapes to blackmail Martin King and actually force him into suicide. This was all part of Hoover's plan to destroy the Black Freedom Movement and any movement that was against what the government was doing, any dissenting movement.
Mumia Abu-Jamal on the radio program Law and Disorder.
There's a new book out this month titled Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. It's edited by Michael Smith, Debbie Smith, and Francis Golden, and packed with 31 essays by a range of left writers and activists. Michael Smith says people who call themselves socialists need to get serious about how to build a new society.
Starting with Marx, revolutionaries were hesitant in trying to spell out what the future would be like. They just, you know, thought, well, we'll see what happens, but we really can't give you a roadmap. But that was 150 years ago. And I think now we can see pretty clearly, well, we certainly can see what's going to happen if we don't change things radically. I mean, the polar ice caps are melting. New York temperature went from 0 degrees to 60 degrees in 2 days. And we really are threatened. I don't want to sound like a prophet of doom, but we really are threatened because of climate change and global warming. We really are threatened with the extinction of humans as a species and all other species. You know, the edges of our country could be underwater in 40 years. That's the truth. And capitalism is a system that has to expand, it has to make the profit, it's utterly irrational, it's out of control, and unless we democratically organize and plan this economy, they're going to kill us, literally, through climate change. So I think we have to start envisioning how you can organize things differently. And that's what a lot of this book does. It's got three sections. The first, which was the easiest, was an indictment of capitalism. I mean, all you got to do is wake up in the morning and open your eyes to see what's wrong with this place. But Paul Street really lays out what's gone wrong. And then the middle section of the book, the visionary section, has chapters on just about everything. If we didn't have a capitalist organized society where things are produced only if it makes a profit, and where private property is the great divide between classes and between people. And then the last part of the book is 10 chapters on how we get from here to there, actually how you go about making the socialist transformation of society. So that's how we laid it out.
You've got 31 essays. Obviously, you made a real effort to get a variety of perspectives on socialism. But how did you put together the mix of writers?
We've been at this for a long time. I've been a socialist for 50 years. My wife also. Frances, I would say, 65 years. So we know a lot of people. And we reached out to comrades that we've met and worked with in the movement over the last period of all those years, and tried to select people who could write about various aspects of a new brave world. Let me give you an idea of some of the chapters. We've got people writing about how in the future what art would be like, healthcare, housing, food, emotional life, sexuality, racism, law, criminal justice, poverty, immigration, drugs, education, science and technology, women, ecology, the democratic organization of the publicly owned economy. It's kind of a broad, far-reaching vision of how everything would be like if we didn't have a 0.1% that rule and control this country. And then the last part has the 10 chapters and how we get from where we are to making what Paul LeBlanc calls in his chapter the Third American Revolution, the Civil War being the second, and the war for independence being the first.
What uses do you envision this book being put to?
I think that we're seeing now a real change in American people's perception of their lot. The Pew organization did a poll a couple years ago, and 49% of young people, and even more amongst African-American young people, but 49% of people generally, young people under the age of 30, said they had a favorable reaction to the word socialism. The Merriam-Webster organization that puts out the dictionary has an online dictionary. And last year, the two most hits words looked up were socialism and capitalism. And just last month, you had this young woman, Kwame Savant, out in Seattle, run as a socialist for city council, ran a socialist campaign against a long-entrenched Democrat, got a huge amount of support from the community and from labor unions, and she won. And then just recently, they tried to red-bait Bill de Blasio when he was running for mayor, calling him a socialist, and the more they tried to red-bait him, the more support he got. And he wound up winning by a landslide. So people are thinking, we want to look at it a different way because this one just isn't working out. So one of the uses we can put to this book is just having a discussion about how things could be different. And once people start thinking that there's an alternative, the old world can fall quickly. And we want to be part of that discussion. And the other thing we did in the book is we've got people contributing from different tendencies, different political parties. And I think that as the radicalization deepens in this country, as we see that going on, there's going to be a reshuffling and a regroupment, and people should start to come together. And the book is a contribution, I think, to that process.
The book seems to be very heavy with people who would call themselves democratic socialists. Was this on purpose?
Well, the powers that be have slandered socialism and trying to make it look like this foreign dictatorial kind of thing. So that's why we emphasize that if we don't have a democratic movement from the bottom up, by definition, that's socialism, and that's what we want. We're not looking at some kind of top-down dictatorship here. So in that sense, people are calling themselves democratic socialists. But I would say the majority of contributors to this book are people who aren't you know, like social democracy, say, in Europe, that tendency has kind of gone along with the whole capitalist program. And in that sense, we're not social democrats. You could define a liberal, say, as someone who doesn't like what capitalism does, but likes capitalism. We're not that at all. We're having a big book launch on January 27th at 7 o'clock at the Housing Works bookstore in Manhattan, in Soho. It's 126 Crosby Street, blocks south of Houston Street. We're having a book launch there, and we donated the books, and if people will come, they can get an inexpensive book. I think it's $10, and a bunch of us are going to be speaking there. Juan Gonzalez will speak, Francis Fox Piven, Francis Golden, me, Blanche Cook, and we'd like to get a chance to meet everybody, sign a copy of the book for them, and get it out there and get the discussion rolling.
So why don't you tell us about at least one of your favorite essays in this compilation?
There's a chapter in the book by Kazembe Balogun. My friend and comrade used to run the program at the Breck Forum. It's called We Be Talking Marx, Where I Come From. And he talks about the long tradition in the black community of black socialists. It goes back to Paul Robeson and James Baldwin, and Martin Luther King, of course, said that if we were going to have true justice in this country, we have to have some kind of democratic socialism. And then he reads a quote from Malcolm X, who, before he was assassinated, was moving towards socialism. And Malcolm said, you can't have a chicken lay a duck's egg. And this country, this society, its economic system, its racism, and it can't lay a duck's egg. And if they ever did, it'd be a punny revolutionary chicken. And I heard Malcolm X speak. I was in college at the University of Wisconsin back in 63, and he came out to speak there. That was one of the great influences of my life. I did poverty law for the Peace Corps in Detroit afterwards in the inner city, and I got the book Malcolm X Speaks, which Pathfinder published, and then the other book, Malcolm X, Evolution of the Revolutionary, written by George Brightman. And I got those two books in all the bookstores in Detroit. So that's been a great influence on my life. And I look upon getting this book out as really a fulfillment of 50 years of working in that direction.
President Obama and National Democratic Party spokespeople now agree that the minimum wage ought to be raised, and the mighty executive pen of the White House will soon force federal contractors to pay workers at least $10.10 an hour. Though this only applies to federal contractors and can be rolled back if Republicans win the White House in 2016, it is better than a sharp stick in the eye. It's also something the president could have done 5 years ago during his first hours in office. Back in 2007 and 2008, when President Obama was candidate Obama, he campaigned on a promise to put legislation through Congress to raise the minimum wage and to reform labor law so as to make it easier for workers to organize unions and to fight for their rights on the job. Both these cynical promises were immediately forgotten when Barack Obama assumed the presidency. And during the 2 years, his party held a thumping majority in the House with a narrow one in the Senate. The administration has never mentioned easing the restrictions on union organizing again. But once in a while, when their poll numbers get low enough, and as long as Republicans are safely in control of the House of Representatives, they dust off their rhetoric on the minimum wage. This is one of those times. To tell the truth, $10.10 an hour is not much. It's such a low floor that it probably can pass the House if Republican leaders ever allow a floor vote on it. But it's far from a wage that will lift anybody out of poverty. The elite bipartisan consensus, that's the president and his spokespeople along with Republicans, agree that the solution is not so much raising the wage for what people already do as training for what will make them fit for better jobs. But that's a joke as well. The U.S. economy isn't producing better jobs. Starbucks is full of baristas with master's degrees, and most college teachers are now adjuncts, which means their advanced degrees enable them to work for poverty wages with few or no benefits. PhD incomes have fallen off a cliff in the last 10 years as colleges and universities reorganize themselves to more resemble the corporations who rule our society. Early in his presidency, the same Barack Obama proposed recalculating Social Security benefits so as to lower them, and late last year, he signed off on the reductions in unemployment compensation that he now wants immoral Republicans to take all the blame for. It's not hard to see that Democrats only take up the cause of the minimum wage when Republicans are in office, to reinforce their fake brand as champions of the oppressed. When Democrats are in power, and raising that wage is a sure and easy thing, their attention drifts somewhere else. But once Republicans get the House or the Senate, they talk about passing a jobs bill, about universal pre-K, and about raising the minimum wage, more to embarrass their Republican partners than with a view towards actually accomplishing any of these things. They are all branding slogans, blatant and shallow hypocrisy, but so far they have worked to reinforce the Democrats' brand as the party of the oppressed. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon. Find us on the web at www.blackagendareport.com.
Baraka was laid to rest at a funeral attended by thousands in his hometown of Newark, New Jersey. The ceremony was a four-hour celebration of Baraka's artistry and politics. The last words were spoken by his son, Ras Baraka, a Newark public school principal who is running for mayor.
Africa runs through our veins. It is the blood in our DNA. It's not our color or our food or religion or our location or our texture of our hair that divides us. It's our ideas, what we believe, and ultimately the side we choose to be on. You cannot be in the middle. All of that is subterfuge, a cloak, a tall tale, a ghost story that keeps us divided while trillions are spent on speculation and advertisement, and most of the world's children grow up in poverty and suffer curable diseases. My father's biggest problem was that he could never just be a mouthpiece. His life had meaning. His words, his stares, his gestures, his grunts all had some real serious purpose. No matter how much money they offered him, how many book deals, movie parts, intellectual accolades, and positions, he just couldn't be anything else. His eyes were too big, his walk too rhythmic. He wouldn't even wear a whole suit. He took the parts that were relevant and added the others as he went. He couldn't be what they wanted him to be. No matter how much of a genius they thought he was, it was undeniable what he could and did create, that the power he had in our lives. He would always be himself, and all the critics, the detractors, like talking machines, regurgitating what was carefully outlined for them, could never really understand him. From Stanley Crouch to the local, less imaginative imps that wanted his warmth but not his fire. They wanted him close enough to feel his energy, but far away enough to deny even to themselves that they ever really wanted to be free. They enjoyed the convenience of slavery. They were not traitors or compradors. They believed that stuff straight out. They thought the civil rights movement was unnecessary, that it would change on its own in time. At least they let us shop at their stores. All we needed was money. He called these people heathens. That is, they didn't have religion, or in this context, spirit. My father was a spiritual man. He couldn't escape it. He bore its name, Imamu, priest. He called Baldwin God's revolutionary mouth. He was God's muse, his song. You could hear it in his voice, his chants, his tapping on the podium, the noises he made, the expressions on his face as he did it. It was a religious act. An exorcism, resisting and confronting the devil. The language in his speech could not just be heard, it was felt. It was connected to that oldest language, that voice that called all things to rise up, that humming, an intense vibration that turned into heat, then life, then music, then us. Imamu was clearly in the middle of that and tried to share it with all of us. I want to tell you about my father, a funny gentleman, a human being, really, that cared for the community's children, that made a safe place for them, that raised hundreds, that married people and gave them names, that loved his children and grandchildren, and introduced us and everyone around us to the world and its music. In fact, I grew up in music, the jazz and blues specifically. If you ever came to my parents' home, his wife, Amina, my mother, of 47 years, their life together, their struggles, their trials and tribulations were also a part of his development and theirs and all of us, really. But if you ever came into this home, you saw books everywhere, the written word, art, and you heard Coltrane or Monk, definitely Ellington and Sun Ra, a few of the big bands like Basie or Bebop, like Charlie Parker, sometimes Mayfield or Marvin Gaye. My mother loved Billy, so she got played. Then Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, Miriam Makeba. I heard Nina Simone play the piano in my living room. Woke up to her one morning and sat and watched Max Roach in the basement of my home. There were parties that went on into the wee hours of the morning. Hours the next day with food from all over the world and most often my mother's famous black beans and rice. There was always poetry read and great speeches given from dignitaries and artists from all over the world. That's why I never understood the moniker of racism they tried to lay on him. I heard artists from Latin America, Africa, the Caribbean, Europe, and activists alike. So I had no choice but to love art, or at least know its relevance to life and the living. My father was like that music, blues people, the music tracing our steps through history, our most tragic episodes and our proudest moments. The music told our story and our changes from slavery to freedom and every episode after. And just like the music changes based on mood, tempo, time, condition, so did our circumstance and so did my father. He was often criticized for being inconsistent or capricious, but the same critics that can't comprehend jazz couldn't explain him either. He, like jazz, always had a consistent beat, an underlying message, something that connected it all together. My father lived his life in the open. He stumbled through this place, and to stumble means to move forward faster. Faster than most of us, that is, as we worried about falling, took easy and careful steps. He was in the rhythm and out of it all at the same time. He took intellectual risks and usually landed square on his feet. Others believe unscientifically that they should always remain the same, no matter what the world is telling them or how fast things move, they will be consistent and remain the same. But to remain in the same place is really to move backwards or be backwards eventually. Everything in the world is in constant motion. Even history is not stuck in the past. All things are in constant motion, some slower than others, but moving nonetheless. My father moved, his ideas moved, and those that were around him and that could keep up with him moved too. The death of Malcolm sped things up a little, and the struggles around the world sped them up even faster. They tried to force him to remain in 1961, but he refused to. They still try to force him to remain there. He still refuses to. The press, the critics, his detractors try and fit him into one refrain, one stanza, but he was moving even today. They write about him and paint a small piece of him, the part they are comfortable with, the part they can explain that fits into their narrative. But my father didn't write for critics. He didn't create because of or for them. He did it because it was a part of him. He was the music, as he says, the blues himself. Anyone that is the same person today that they were 20 years ago is someone that is not alive. Anyone that thinks and understands the world the same way they did 10 years ago has not traveled. Anyone that has not evolved 5 years from now is someone that is afraid to encounter himself. My father is a revolutionary. And in that is the word evolve, or at least revolve, to turn, transform, transcend, to be transblusing. Jesus was a revolutionary. He told us in his scripture that when he was a child, he spoke as a child. And he himself evolved into something higher, greater, something spiritual that most can't explain. So they just call it Holy Ghost. But without disrespect, he was no ghost. He was very real, very musical, very transblusant, and causes every hand to clap and every feet to stomp. And when you go to a good service, you can't help but to get up and dance. My father began to understand that we are all connected everywhere, that the families on Clinton Avenue have more in common with workers in Ireland and Haiti and Ghana and South America and Mexico and Egypt than they could ever imagine. He began to understand, like King did, that our enemy was poverty, disease, and the people that got rich off of it. He understood that we need to control our resources and use them for our benefit, that this by itself is dangerous. He wanted to control his own voice, wanted to speak in a way that he saw fit, not in a neat way laid out for him. He improvised, and when things got tougher, he improvised some more. More importantly, he told the truth, which disturbed some because they worshipped lies and liars and took turns reinventing lies. Their existence was based on lies, and anything even resembled the truth scared them to death. My father rose for a minute around Christmas Day, laughing and joking, but always clear, introducing me to the nurses and doctors, saying, "You know my son? He's running for mayor. You know my son?" He supported me, not just because I am his son, but because we are right. The people are pushing back against conservative, backward ideas. Millionaires that refuse to pay their fair share, and elected ones that shut down government and refuse people Social Security and unemployment checks. People that hate unions and immigrants. The people are tired of bankers and hedge fund guys robbing their savings and foreclosing on their homes. They're pushing back against those that stand in the way of living wages and equal pay for equal work. They want domestic jobs and economic development plans, not billions for drones and more wars. People want courageous, democratic leadership, not bullies and demagogues. And that same group that united to elect President Obama is beginning to come together locally and elect local leadership and push for change in these cities all over America. This is the beginning of a progressive period. And we have to buttress it and exacerbate it with art and music and dance and essays and murals and fresh ideas. So I'm calling all culture workers to get to work, to uplift, energize, and analyze, speak truth to power, excite these young people to embrace life and not to take their own, to build and control their neighborhoods and not destroy it, to read more and write more, to get them to see the world with themselves in it, the same way my father did for many of you. He taught us to understand that no matter what color tie you put on it, no matter how many letters are behind it, or the schools it went to, or how well you dress it up, or what language it speaks, a lie will always be a lie, and the people are tired of lies. They want to control their own schools and want to improve them themselves. They want to work to increase their wages. They want decent housing and to be able to feed their families. They want education for their children. They want their children alive and not in jail. They need creativity, not death marches. They want more democracy, not less. They're tired of dirty politics and dirty politicians. They want to see themselves in power and every motion used to push them further ahead. My father loved this city of ours. He was a Newarker to his core and made his final transition here in the South Ward in Beth Israel Hospital. He could have probably lived anywhere in the world, in Europe, in Africa, the West Indies, because he was loved and welcomed all over the planet. Because he chose to fight here, so do I. And hundreds of thousands of people like me. And even at the end of it all, he remained organizing and pushing that rock up the hill, determined to do so as Sisyphus, he would say, the gods trying to roll it back down on his head. He pushed, still one big, long, heavy push until his last breath escaped him and his heart beat for the last time. Have you ever seen black fire? I mean, the fire itself, black, it burns deep. It never goes out. A volcanic whirlwind, a heat of blue-black fire. You can feel its warmth through and through millions of miles away. It has its own wind. Many feel it but can't discover its origin. Sun Ra language and tongues only heard about. It gives birth, creates, and reproduces itself into itself, and all around it there is life. It burns brick, makes a hole in our caged mind. It's the light of the North Star at its base. It's darkness in triple stages. Yeah, the bluest of black I ever felt. Have you ever seen black fire? It burns deep. It never goes out. It is at the origin of things, the thought that thought of itself and turned itself into itself. It is Malcolm. It is Malcolm's voice, 116th Street, final call in his left hand. It hides in the screams at the Audubon Ballroom, impregnating our children's minds with self-determination. Have you ever seen black fire? It burns deep. It never, ever goes out. Have you ever seen black fire? It burns deep. It never, ever goes out. You can smell it in the cinders of civil rights chants of 17-year-olds on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, dodging water hoses. It's that next time fire, Baldwin shouted. At its core, you can hear it burning. You can hear it glowing. You can hear it growing like a whisper, a steady hum, a djembe drum beating against our conscience, waking our desire to be human, to be in tune with the world as it moves, burning individualism and greed. It will drive you sane. It is Pinero's cause and because. It is Albizu dancing bomba on the heads of his captors. It is a freedom dance. Have you ever seen black fire? It burns deep. Deep, it never goes out. It is the answer to the question most asked. Why, and why again, said Imamu. It'll make you wise. It is the Underground Railroad, the way out, Huey's Red Book, Lumumba's spirit, Mandela's raised fist. It rests in the palms of friends of mine, waiting to explode all over the next day, our day after, our right nouns and light up our tomorrows. We are an army of soldiers. We are an army of soldiers, of artists, armed only with our language and our history, vowing never to be slaves again, to be against poverty and dead children before their time, to live forever and forever and forever, and finish the sentences of writers long gone. Have you ever seen black fire? It burns deep. It never goes out. You can try to extinguish it, but it never goes out. It never, ever goes out, only up. Or out as in broad, as in multiply, as in blues, black bass of the fire, dancing, flickering at times, but never all the way gone. Dancing, flickering at times, but never all the way gone. Dancing, flickering at times, but never all the way gone. It is Baraka's legacy. Black fire, hot beboppers, musical geniuses, magical words that burn holes all the way to freedom. Hey, Imamu! Imamu, black fire, where are you? Imamu, black fire, where are you? Where are you, black fire? Imamu, where are you? Black fire, Imamu, where are you? Black fire, Imamu, where are you? Where are you, black fire? Imamu, where are you? Black fire, whalers, 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 whale on!
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.